Hello, everybody, and welcome to Safety First for Working with Trauma. We have Suzanne Fagel, that's myself, Craig Wiener, and our guest Ann Adams on the call. And who we are is Craig and I teach together an online webinar called Tapping Out of Trauma. And we thought that this was an important topic for people who are EFT practitioners to pay some attention to. And we have our guest, Ann Adams, too, who's with us. And I'm going to pass you over to Craig right now so he can introduce Ann to you.
Well, this is a real pleasure and an honor to have Ann on the call with us. I can't imagine that if you've been involved with EFT, you don't know who Ann is. But for those of you who don't, Ann Adams has over 40 years of experience as a licensed clinical social worker in the mental health field. She's been working with clients and practitioners, well, for a long time. I won't say how long. She specializes now in really helping the helpers and helping practitioners gain mastery. If you don't know, she was also worked closely with the creator of EFT, Gary Craig, on a lot of projects and was the director of the former EFT Master's Program. She's currently working on reestablishing a Master's Program for EFT with AMET. She was the first American to receive Trainer of Trainers certification from AMET in the U.S. And basically, Ann just presents on a variety of EFT-related topics at conferences and training programs around the world. She's written 3 books, and if you've taken an EFT certification program, you've probably worked with one of them. I can guarantee it. For more information on Ann, you can always find out more at fromthedeskofannadams.com. So it is without really further ado and joy that I introduce Ann Adams all the way from Georgia. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Craig. It's nice to be here. So let's just launch right on into this.
Looking forward to this call that's really so timely and so important. So I'm going to let you go ahead and just get things started today.
Okay. Well, let's just start by what do you mean by safety and why is safety so important, an essential element really in working with trauma?
Okay. I'd like to take a stab at that to start with. So the creation of a container which is ideal both for the practitioner and the client, which is the essential element we think of safety, this creation of this container, is that both of them should be able to feel at ease, not judged in any way, respected, and physically free from anxiety with the surroundings. Comfortable in the context of a working relationship with each other, informed about the process in which they are about to engage, and also that they have the freedom to ask any relevant questions and express any relevant concerns. So that's the sort of general essential element of working with trauma, the creation of this container. Initially, and then we're going to also talk later on about some specifics, but that's what we feel like is pretty essential to safety to begin with. So, Ann, are there any other thoughts or comments you want to add?
Yes. I think quite often we talk a lot about rapport and how important it is to establish that. But rapport is not just something that's established when you first get started. Rapport is actually re-earned and redone every time you do anything, open your mouth for that matter. Because think about it, by definition, trauma really overwhelms people's protective defenses, their sense of safety, their sense of confidence. And they're feeling a victim. So they're really sort of looking at you and sort of testing out the waters to see how well that you're dealing with what their issues are. And one of the things about being at ease, it's very important. We've talked a lot about that, too, of doing your own work. And because by doing your own work, you're then much more at ease and able to be fully present with your client. And the non-judgment part, don't kid yourself, your client is going to be judging you. But judgment is a history thing. If you're fully present in the present, there's no past to judge or future to judge, and you're just what is in the moment. So that sense of presence is really, really important. And that sense of being respected. It's empathy for their defenses. They're going to have defenses. So you make empathic remarks, sort of like, you know, this is hard for you, that sort of thing.
You know, you really brought up some key points. Rapport being the essential element that shows up as a result of safety. I love the empathic presence and comments that you brought in. All really, really very critical points. And, you know, as Bessel van der Kolk will say, that healing doesn't happen without safety.
No.
Right? So this is just, I think sometimes practitioners assume that they're being safe because they're not physically harming, they're not doing anything, but the subtler layers of learning how to provide safety are really what we teach in the course and what we're talking about today, of so many things to be aware of beyond what they may already be aware of. It's kind of the what they don't know, they don't know. So one of the things I just wanted to make a specialty note of with regard to safety that you also alluded to was the elements of practitioner safety for the well-being of the practitioner. I think we mostly think about the client. And that exists, as far as I'm concerned, on two levels. One is a personal one, and like you said before, our personal work is really so critical. To be personally safe as a practitioner, you should only be working at the level of experience that you have and the level of training you have as far as who you're working with and what issues, and also your personal trauma history. You know, Suzanne had shared a story with that's such a critical one, is having lived through a natural disaster. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she might not choose to work with somebody that's dealing with the trauma of that particular type of natural disaster because she knows that she might be a little bit more vulnerable. And for all of us, if we have a trauma history, whether it's fully resolved or even just triggering, we have to bring that awareness so that we can be safe and not receive what we call vicarious or secondary trauma. And so that's on a personal level. On a professional one, we also have to watch our practice liability, right? So how are we keeping our practice safe by pre-screening for scope of practice issues? What are we looking for and what do we have our initial intake forms? Are we having a verbal consultation with the person ahead of time that can show up red flags for somebody we may or may not work with? So those are really important issues as regarding practitioner safety. But also client safety, I think. Suzanne, did you have some things to add?
Yes. So specifically with regard to questions for client safety, these are some of the things that we would want to make sure would be included. Does the room or the space feel safe for the client? Now, that may seem like a crazy question if you're in a somewhat neutral-looking space, but I actually had an incident one time where I was meeting in a space that was not mine. It was a meeting space, but there was a picture on the wall, and the client took one look at the picture and went into a complete trauma ab reaction because it was a picture that was in the room where the trauma occurred for her. So, it's interesting to note things like that. So how sort of neutral is the space? Is there any freedom for choice regarding personal space boundaries in the room? Are there choices of chairs, or is there the possibility that you could invite them to pick the place they'd like to sit, and so they have a choice about how they orient themselves in the room with regard to their personal space boundaries? Is it noted and addressed from the outside whether the client is regulated, that is to say, is calm and present, or if they have some arousal? Maybe they've come in rushing, and so they're kind of head up and sort of like, oh, I'm so sorry I'm late, and they're not fully present. So, you know, to be safe, you would want to give them a chance to calm down and get present. Another thing for client safety is, does this client feel like they're being heard? Are you truly present and hearing what they have to say? You also might want to check to see if he or she is racing too quickly into revealing their trauma history. We know that there is a thing called the trauma pull, and often people who have a trauma story want to just blurt it out as fast as they can, and sometimes they say it before they almost even sit down. So you want to make note of that, and for their safety to, you know, be able to say, you know, I really would like to hear your story, but I'm wondering if we could just land here first and get present. Are they moving too quickly into emotional intensity or repeatedly going into emotional intensity or abreaction? And you want to make note of that, because if that's happening really repeatedly, then they're probably not feeling too safe in this situation. Or on the other side of that, are they showing up as being very numb or very dissociated or kind of like spacey? Do they not feel present because they're either really shut down or just seem like they're somewhere else but not really in the room, which doesn't create for a safe environment either? And do you have any other things that you would like to add about either the practitioner or client safety?
Well, I think you've brought up some excellent points, and would like to go back to something that Craig was talking about pre-screening. It is so important to know who that client is who's sitting across from you. You know, to do an intake and the time it takes to get some past history is very useful. You know, you want to know things of, you know, the age of onset and stage, you know, the stage of development they were actually in then. You know, what kind of trauma, how long did it last? Was it repetitive? You know, is it chronic? Is there what we call comorbid situations? Alcohol and drug abuse, for instance, is very common with people with severe trauma. And quite often after trauma, there's some personality changes in that, you know, somebody who was nice and easygoing is now always hyper about things. And, you know, you've made some really good points, too, Suzanne, about when folks walk into the room and what they're presenting at that particular moment. You know, one of the things that we need to do sometimes to make someone feel at ease is simply some, you know, deep breathing or other grounding or relaxation exercises with that. But no matter how good of a intake you may take, sometimes those things don't come out until, you know, late. Not only, Suzanne, do they have the ones who they want to tell it to you too quick. You know, you've got the other folks who really are not even aware that it's buried underneath it. I remember a client I had who was referred to me by another practitioner, and the practitioner sent her intake, and it was supposed to be one of these, you know, quick, easy kinds of things. I should have known better. And, you know, when we got into it, you know, there was chronic, repetitive, horrendous trauma in her background that she basically had blocked for a very long time. And it actually took, she was very dissociative, and it actually took about 8 sessions before we could, you know, get the situation calm enough to even be able to effectively tap with her. And I think that's a challenge we have sometimes, because our tools in the energy world can be so powerful and work so quickly that sometimes we may miss those subtle signs that client's not ready. You know, I'm convinced that one of the reasons sometimes folks don't come back for another session, you go, well, gosh, it was such a great session, but that, you know, you really literally have gone too fast, too much, too soon, and
yeah.
Really impacted the defenses that they had up, and it was just, you left them feeling too vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, I just want to, number one, thank you. A lot of good points there. And to just add a few things to that, number one is I agree that because tapping and EFT can work so quickly sometimes and so deeply, so quickly, the plus and the minus of that, right, or the light and dark of that. On one hand, people start feeling vulnerable, start going deeply, start revealing things very, very quickly, perhaps even quicker than is appropriate for them to be able to integrate,
right.
And we need to slow them down. And that's an important kind of guide dog element that we're doing. We're not necessarily leading, and we're not pulling them. We're never forcing. And in fact, we're often more slowing their pacing down. You know, some of the things I notice in mentoring practitioners is as they develop their skills and their skills of observation and presence, for example, eye contact. One, we often are kind of like seeking their eyes to see how they're doing. But on the other hand, if they're looking around the room and looking down, they're not ready to have eye contact with us. And we don't want to force them faster than the slowest part of them can handle. So as we become more aware of their physiological reactions, of their postural changes, how they're holding their body, the pace at which they're moving or talking, all of those things really come with awareness and learning and integration into being a skillful practitioner. But not forcing is really, really important for me. Good. Okay, so how about, we're talking about many of the things to notice for client safety. What kind of things can happen in a session that cause a lack of safety for both the client and the practitioner? So what things that, if they're absent, make an ad reaction more likely? Suzanne, I'm going to let you start with that one.
Okay, Craig, thanks. Well, first of all, to notice whether either you as the practitioner or the client is feeling dysregulated, and by that I mean that their nervous system is not in a place of regulation, which means that they're going to show up either very kind of anxious or hyper or, again, shut down or numb. And so an awareness on the part of the practitioner about the nature and the characteristics of trauma in general could lead to someone not seeing that, the practitioner not seeing that in a client, and that's going to cause a lack of safety. Similarly, a lack of skillful observation and awareness of the practitioner, and Anne just noted some of those things a minute ago, regarding their own and the client's physiological and psychological state. So, you know, are you able to notice, for instance, that their heart is racing, that their breathing is shallow, or does the client have a history of have a mental illness diagnosis? You want to make sure that you know that and understand that. And then a really, really common one that we have found that creates a lack of safety is a lack of skill for the practitioner in deep listening. And the way that commonly can show up is if they're not repeating back the exact words that the client is giving as they're tapping. And they're just making up words or changing the words willy-nilly. And it's like, if I'm a client, I am not going to feel safe because I'm going to think this person is not listening to what I'm saying. Another thing that could create a lack of safety is a practitioner personal bias that is made evident, either with regard to their personal ethics or the practitioner's personal ethics or religious view or gender prejudice. And a practitioner might hold it. I mean, we're not always going to agree as practitioners on everything who our client is. But the question is, can you put that aside enough to not be evident that you might hold a different point of view? Because if you can't, that is that the client's going to pick that up. Also, again, as I said, if the space is triggering, I talked about the picture on the wall before. Another example was somebody who is who has a particular business with pet grief, and she wanted to bring a puppy in, and we were saying, well, if this person has just experienced the loss of a beloved pet, having a puppy in the room might be quite triggering. So you never know, and sometimes you can't know until you see the response of the person, and then you do your best to figure out what the issue is and say, okay, what can we do to remedy this so you feel safe? Because, you know, things are going to happen, and you're going to find that, you know, that for whatever reason, the person might not feel safe. Another possible thing that could cause a lack of safety is noise distraction, electronic interruptions, email dings, cell phones, or even loud traffic outside. Especially loud traffic for someone, like I think of some of the veterans that I work with, who any loud noise is triggering. When the rapport is broken, so again, if the practitioner alters the client's words in a tapping session, or is tapping at a different pace than the client and not paying attention to the client's pacing, or if there's no prosody of voice, and by prosody of voice I mean the kind of tone of the voice that is soothing and reassuring, like I'm speaking now. It's called prosody of voice. Or word intonations or emphasis. So lots of times when people are tapping, and sometimes it's okay, but you have to be pretty skillful about this. It's like, you know, and it was really frightening for you. You know, you're putting an emphasis in there that they're not giving you in a tapping sequence. So to watch for that so that you're not giving an emphasis that they're not putting on words, and it's maybe more your issue. And lastly, and one other thing that I think is really important is, are you using the name the client prefers? To take the time to stop and ask, what name do you prefer? Because often people will write down a name on an intake form or whatever, but they'll say, oh, well, actually, I like to be called such and such. I had an experience once where a practitioner called me Susan instead of Suzanne, and I asked her several times. I kept saying my name is Suzanne, and she just kept calling me Susan, and that was the last time I went to her. And finally, and this is really important, that confidentiality is not maintained. And it can be as simple as someone who refers somebody and you go to thank the person who referred, but you haven't done it without permission of the client. So say Susie refers Joan to you. You want to make sure you check with Joan first to see if it's okay that I am letting Susie know that you referred Joan. So it seems small, but it's really important to not speak about a client ever without his or her permission. Anne, anything you want to add?
Yes, you've made some excellent points I'd like to comment about. You know, one of the things is the difference in values that you may have with your client. And the reality is that we're going to have different values than folks, and it's how strong you hold that value. I remember a mentoring class I had, they said, well, what do you do if you really disapprove of what it was that he did? You know, in the case of, say, a Christian counselor who, and somebody comes in with the guilt from an abortion, for instance, and there's such a mismatch there that, you know, there's no law that says that you should have to see anybody and everybody. You know, you do it respectfully and kindly that, you know, it sounds like that you could be better served by this counselor over here. And that's why it's so important to have referral sources, so that if you're not qualified or not skilled or not comfortable for whatever reason in working with somebody, that you've got a ready list of folks that you could refer to. The other thing you mentioned about the triggering space, we do try to make it as neutral as possible, but because we're never, ever going to know, it could be the music playing in the background or something, that, you know, it's learning to handle that trigger, and there's a real therapeutic opportunity there in handling the trigger that does come up, and how you manage that. Not to be surprised, not to be put down in any way, not to, you know, wonder, well, what are you upset about, or any judgment that goes in that is critical in really getting them to go deeper with it. And to use their exact words is also really important. I don't change any word without asking somebody, is that right? Does that fit? Is there a better word? And their name, that's a perfect thing. I had a client in another country, and oftentimes, whether they're in my class or a client, you know, names are difficult for me to pronounce, being a Southern girl from Georgia, it's my Southern accent here. But it's so important to make every effort to use the name and try to say it the way that they say it. I remembered one young man that really was, it was difficult, but I kept trying until I got it kind of right. And his, he had all along said, it doesn't matter, it's okay, you can call me anything. But that's really not true, because once we got it right and said, I said, well, how's that? He says, that's just music to my ears, thank you. So it really is important that, that you, you are able to pronounce their name and use it. They like that. You made a comment about eye contact, and not everybody is comfortable with eye contact. Not everybody's comfortable with you, you know, staring at them with a firm contact with your eyes all the time. Many people are much more comfortable, you know, talking to the wall, for instance, rather than directly looking at you. And partly it can be a cultural thing. And that's one of the things about knowing who the person who is who's sitting across from you, to not have that sort of mismatch. And we can have mismatches in lots of ways. And another one would be the expectations that somebody has of how long it would take to be in therapy, for instance. Some people think, well, it's going to take years, and you've worked with a particular kind of problem and realize it's not going to take that long. Others are thinking, you know, well, this should take three visits and I should be all done. And others are expecting, say, you to do EFT in a certain particular way, like they read about it in a book and that you've modified it somewhat. So it's back to that container of safety to really discuss up front their expectations about what they, you know, want the what they're expecting that session to be about. One of the ways that I try to get feedback at the end of each session from folks is to ask them, you know, did something happen in the session that you would like to see more of, or is there something that didn't happen in the session that you'd like to work on next time? So you get some valuable information by getting that kind of feedback. The other thing I make sure that I that makes folks feel safe is some educational things, to understand that resistance is normal. That, you know, like Craig said, you really can only go as fast as the slowest part is, of you is willing to go. And for the most part, we're all resistant in some way. You know, if there was no resistance, if there was no conflict, they probably wouldn't be in your office. They would have, you know, resolved the thing and moved on. And it, this is a good place to insert a phrase that I use a good bit with folks, is that the process of EFT can be simple, but people can be very, very complex, and we really need to respect that.
And that's awesome. I love that one. That's like a perfect infographic. I love that.
Yeah, I really like that too. I say it a lot. Well, are we ready to go on to the next question?
No, actually, I wanted to add a few thoughts, so I just wanted to validate so many of the things that you said. It's just a real honor and pleasure to be kind of doing going around here. Part of what you're talking about is in setting up the container is that informed consent process, what they can expect and what they can't expect the sessions, what happens when. So you're reducing the likelihoods of challenging communications when you talk about what happens if we go over or don't go over the hour. Should they expect you responding to emails in between sessions? So all those things ahead of time help to reduce the chance of those miscommunications.
Right.
And pre-framing with invitational language for feedback, which is what you're saying. If this happens, please let me know that. If at any point what I ask you needs to change, what I'm saying needs to change. And so continuing to pre-frame in advance is so important. And thank you also for the mention of the cultural paradigm as far as eye-to-eye contact, et cetera. Cultural differences are a huge piece of providing a safe space of what words can be said, what language is it all right to use. You know, if you're a person that curses a practitioner and you have a religious practitioner, that's, you know, an incredible break of rapport, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so let's go ahead and go on. You have another question, Ann?
Okay. Well, so how does that feeling of unsafety show up for a client in their session? So how can dysregulation be detected, to use the fancier words?
Yeah, well, I think that being mindful, present, and using all of our sensory capacities is really critical for observing that, right? So number one, I'll say, yes, by doing our own work, we're not dealing with our own stuff during a session, so we can be more fully present for the client, and that's obvious but important to say. But how it might show up in the client is them starting to change the pace of their voice, either getting really fast or really slowing down. We're observing and listening and making note of their breath. Is it starting to move into a breathiness or a shallow breathing? And how's their breathing changing? Is their belly softening and expanding or changing and going the other direction? Are they starting to get scattered in their speech and jumping around a lot or incomplete sentences? Do you find them shifting around a lot in their chair, really just kind of squiggling and feeling uncomfortable in their space and need to be in a different space or go in a different direction? So we're just observing all of these things. We're watching and listening for any kind of skittishness as they're telling their story and if they're verbally jumping from here to there. If you're watching them really just, and none of these are absolutes, but if you're really watching them start to collapse physically, slumping in the chair, it could be a sign of relaxation or it could be a sign of dissociation, separation, so we're watching for all of that. Are they using words that describe signs of dissociation and going numb and not feeling anything and all of a sudden talking about a particular issue, not being able to find something located in their body, for example? So, you know, all those are signs that we're being mindful as a practitioner to sense that they're starting to move toward dysregulation so that we can change tack, so to speak, and allow them to become more regulated, especially if we're approaching working with the trauma. Anybody else have anything to add with that?
I think those are some really good points. I would like to make one point about dissociation, that that word's kind of thrown around a good bit, and actually it just simply means that that person is no longer present with you in the room. They are in their heads, gone someplace else. And while some EFT folks say that they just keep on tapping with the dissociation, I think it's such an important piece of what we're doing with people that it's important to stop and recognize that and help them come back, you know, to the present. I really don't see that it's very effective to utilize the energy work very much when they're just literally not there with you.
Can I just underline and highlight and italicize that one? That's such an important part of what we go over in the Tapping Out of Trauma course that we get feedback on from students about, I really didn't realize what I didn't know about that.
Right.
And now that I start to understand the neurobiology of trauma and have started to experience that slowing it down, boy, the differences that have been made. So I just wanted to really highlight that point. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to put it, that they don't know what they don't know. And that's one of the ways.
You know what, it's hard because in, you know, basic level EFT courses in all the organizations, there's so much to cover technique-wise.
Right.
That they don't to go into this much depth, nearly this much depth of what we're talking about here.
No,
so
that's true.
So what? So as we go in that direction of kind of some of the neuroscience, which we talk a lot about, what are some of the elements that create safety, and how does safety, a sense of safety, show up for the client? Suzanne, you want to take that one on to start?
Sure. So as we were just talking about in the form of dissociation, this is a time for a really effective use of what we call interpersonal neurobiology. And interpersonal neurobiology basically involves the rapport that is established between the practitioner and the client. And there are some very specific signs that are visible that can demonstrate that there is a good rapport, and when there is a good rapport, people feel safe. So, effective use of interpersonal neurobiology would be, again, including the prosody and the tempo of the voice. So, if you've got somebody that's really agitated in front of you, or even fairly far away in their heads, you know, being able to say their name, you know, Joan, I'm here with you in this room. Can you please notice and that we're here in this room? Feel your feet on the ground. And if you as the practitioner are paced and calm and balanced and using this nice sort of sing-song tone of voice, this prosody, and you modulate the tempo of your voice, you're also in that calm state having a good heart rate. And you can actually use that and your breath to entrain with the other client. There's a whole science called heart math that goes into this in a lot of depth, but what we know is that if you are in a calm state, breathing calmly and with your voice modulated, you can actually pull the person from either an agitated state or a dissociated state back into the room. Also, soft eye contact. As Anne mentioned, not everybody wants to keep looking at you all the time. But in this case, to create safety and to make safety visible, you want to know that you have some eye contact with them. And you can keep it soft. You don't have to be staring at them. But you want to know that they're seeing you and that they're seeing you in the room. So even if they're just glancing and then looking away, as long as when they glance, they're really connecting with you, that's a kind of a soft eye contact. And also your body language and emotional stance should be calm, relaxed, and yet at the same time interested. So you want to be, as all of those add up to, a kind of presence. Now, another thing that we go into a lot in the course, but we'll mention here, is the neurophysiology of safety through resourcing the client. Now, just briefly, a resource would be any person or animal or nature or a particular place in nature or an object, maybe a work of art or a piece of music, that brings only feelings of well-being to the client. And maybe at the beginning of the session, but also when things, when someone might get triggered, to bring them back to this resource. So one of the things you would want to do is to start to make a list of resources with the client and to, Anne's right, educate. Say, we're going to build this list of resources. This is helpful. And to get them to come back to this resource that brings only feelings of well-being, and establish that as a felt sense. So say they're talking about their dog and you have them imagining petting their dog. You would say to them, what makes you know you feel good about this activity of petting your dog? And they might say, oh, well, I have this nice warm feeling in my chest. So you want to help them identify the good feeling. Or I have the sensation of a smile in my cheek muscles. And what you do when you work with these resources is to create positive neural pathways or networks in the brain that promote neural regulation, that promote balance and presence, and diminish the intensity of the emotion. So the use of resources in creating safety and also helping to see, to make that a visible thing to both of you in the room, a tangible thing, is by working with resources. And we also know that somatically working with the body stimulates the positive neurotransmitters and hormones for well-being. So in a lot of different ways, you're helping them to come to a place of safety or come back to a place of safety. It's a place you want to begin the session with, and it's a place you want to continually bring people back to if they become really triggered. Anne, I want to add anything here?
Well, I think you've made some really good points with that, using lots of big words that I tend not to use with the clients. I'll tell you a story. I talk about sometimes how a panic or how negative feelings happen in the brain. And so I was trying to do the whole thing about the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala and all of that. And finally I said, okay, let's just give everybody a little name here. So, you know, Frank had a negative thought, and, you know, that triggered Amy, the amygdala, who, you know, passes on the message to Thal, the hypothalamus, who then, you know, kicks into the Andy and, the two guys who kick out all the chemicals. And so that's the way that that you make get yourself upset. I should have written that story out, but you get the general idea that by giving it more simplistic names, the client themselves understands that better. So you wouldn't be saying the neurophysiology of safety through resourcing to the client, and I'm not sure you don't, but the talking about how we get positive feelings and emotions, you know, from other things, people, places, et cetera, and to really resource that. When the Red Cross comes in with disaster relief, they're really keen on tying people back in resources they had and reminding them of what they used to do to make themselves feel better and to calm themselves. So I think that's a very important aspect of what it is that you're trying to do with someone, is to tie them back into, you know, what are the positive things and the positive sources and tools that they have in order to self-regulate and calm themselves down again.
Great. Craig, do you want to add anything?
No, I think you guys really covered that very well. I don't really have anything to add.
Okay. So, Anne, I want to ask you a question, please. In your words, how can re-traumatization happen in a tapping session?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think EFT and other modalities have got probably some terrific tools to calm people. You know, much of it is a very calming thing, that you are focusing in on the negative thing that you're in story or image, and that there's. I think there's probably a little less chance of that happening using EFT if it's applied at the right time on the right size of issue that the client is ready to deal with. However, EFT is a powerful tool, and that also, as you're tapping, and I'm sure anybody who's used it for any length of time show that also brings things up. The trauma is stored in our body, often in very small parts and pieces. The smell, the taste, the sounds, the posture, the tone of voice, the words, etc., may be in different sections of our brain. By definition, it's scattered in a traumatic event. And so sometimes tapping can bring that back up, and you've got a real cleaning up job to do. So to be very cautious about, as you're tapping, that what else is coming up that you're not rushing or overwhelming the person, because you know you got to know your own limits, and you know your clients can be inadvertently traumatized by things that we're doing that is not appropriate, and we don't, I don't mean not appropriate like you're doing something on purpose, but it can be very small things, because the signs you're looking for are quite often very subtle. And many people who've lived with trauma for a very long time have got a lot of experience in covering up exactly how they feel and what is going on. So you're back to doing your own work to make sure that you're more able to see. Because in essence, most everybody's ambivalent about opening up to that buried or hidden pain. We're all in a conflict. We really need to respect the people's protective defenses. And I think that that's probably one of the most common ways that people get re-traumatized, is that we have these strong tools that seem to work so fast that we tend to want to just move on through, whereas to really slow down, get to know who's in front of you. You know, again, remember the details they've told you, use their words, but then we tend to go on to, well, what happened next? Well, that's sometimes not the best thing to say, because in our effort to go deeper quickly, you know, we may miss the fact that their protective defenses are like, whoa, no, that's too much too soon. So, you know, what happens to that? You know, you've attacked the defenses, and you've opened up more than that client cares to deal with. You know, and in so doing, you've hurt the trust you've built up so hard. You're going to have to backpedal a whole lot, and perhaps even damaged what work has been done. It's like, oh, no, this is too much. It's too scary. It's too far. So, again, it's really about doing your own work, really, really learning to watch those subtle signs, because what they're doing actually is testing you out at every step, and they offer an invitation that, okay, we can go this far, and then they see how that works, and then you give some knowledge and you give some more confidence to be fully present, and you know, then they can kind of like go into the next step. Kind of take the picture of, you know, remember those two men saws that cut down those huge trees? You know, you're on one side of it and they're on the other, and you're just holding your end until they pull you toward them. They're inviting you in. And then you can do your part in helping them dig out and pull out what the next step of what they want to do, and then you wait again for the next invitation. But absolutely, I think the re-traumatization can happen in a variety of ways, not necessarily on purpose or anything, but it's back to that you don't know what you don't know, and to really spend the time and energy and sometimes money to learn what all you need to know to keep your clients safe is really the only ethical, responsible thing to do. And I love what Stephen Porges said. He says, if you want to improve the world, start by making people feel safer. And it really is totally all about safety.
Perfect. Perfect. And, you know, what I'd just like to add is that, and I know you know this, but as EFT trainers and mentors and working with practitioners that are early on and that are very excited and they see the amazing changes that tapping did for them, they don't necessarily early on develop the subtleties. Like, I know, for example, that early traumas, you know, set off a lot of core beliefs. So John here, what's the first time that this ever happened to you? And we jump into, like, first-time questions, and we open things up, just as you said with the perfect saw analogy, that they're not ready to go to yet. You have to let them take you. But I think sometimes, especially in early practice and enthusiasm, to get to the root of things, to help people, to not have it take a year and all those things, that practitioners, it's pretty common, especially early ones, to jump in too fast, too quick, and then lose that rapport or do damage. And I have to say, for me, I have a personal thing that is the shadow side of EFT, because on one hand, it's so beautifully effective and so powerful and so deep, often so quickly, that we need, as mentors and teachers, to continue to advocate for pacing and slowness, because reactions and re-traumatization does happen. And we have to know that and own that and not say it doesn't. So it's a really important piece. And that really is, I'd say, the perfect segue to how do you learn more about these things, and how do you take what we just covered, even though we covered a lot of information, we did so on a kind of superficial level. There's so much more to be learned with this, and that's why we developed, Suzanne and I, this 8-week webinar. And so once a week, you know, if you're interested in this work and taking it deeper, for 8 weeks, you'll receive a video teaching and the PDFs and an online forum and monthly calls and a variety of things that you could see on the Tapping Out of Trauma page, which the next one begins in September, so September 11th, and it goes for 8 weeks. We have continuing education credits for quite a number of professions, nurses, marriage and family therapists, social workers, etc. And for those people that are interested, Suzanne, did you want to mention some of the things that are in the course?
Yes. So it's a pretty rigorous course, definitely is going to need to take some time and energy to take it all in. So it's 8 weeks again, and we cover things like the physiology of stress and trauma, how to understand neuroregulation, the whole aspect of interpersonal neurobiology with stress and trauma, learning how to do resourcing, and the whole notion of somatic oscillation for processing of trauma. We look at some of the signs and symptoms of complex trauma and PTSD, and also about understanding vicarious trauma, and most especially how and when to refer to specialists if you need to. So it does require a time commitment, and it's helpful to those people who are getting certified now, and seasoned practitioners, and even those with mental health licenses, we found have benefited from this course. You can work through your own schedule in that you do not have to watch the seminar live to participate, but it is time sensitive in the sense that it runs for 8 weeks, but there is an option if you don't quite get through it that you can sign up again, and we have a lot of people that take the course again and again, but you can watch anytime. And again, it's www.tappingoutoftrauma.com. So I think, Anne, we're going to leave you with the last word. What, anything you'd like to say about the course or any other wrap-ups you'd like to talk about safety when working with EFT?
Well, I think what you're doing meets a real need within the field, because Craig was right. There's so much to teach in an EFT class, and even during the mentoring, you're not going to get all of the same information. You know, what you're planning and doing is chock full of real information. I actually took your class so that I could, you know, see what was going on. I try to keep up, particularly with the new things that are going on with trauma. I also was looking for something that I could actually refer, you know, my folks to, so that, you know, you really could learn the basic things of what you need to know and fill in the gaps about trauma. And I think your class really well does that. So, you know, I enjoyed it, and take my hat off to you guys, because, like I said, the best way to improve the world is to help people feel safer.
I'm a developer of the master's program that's upcoming for AMET, for all the work that you've done with your textbooks, and for us, that's just, we're just honored to have you participating in the class on today's call and recommending it. That's it is a real honor, because we worked hard at it, but at integrating the material, but you coming on and saying kind words, we really appreciate it. So thank you so much for coming on the call today. For anybody that found this recording somewhere else other than the tappingoutoftrauma.com, please go there. You can find recommended resource books that we recommend. You can find out more about the course, how to register, and you want to also know that if you want to find out more about Anne's work, go to www.fromthedeskofanneadams.com. Right? Did I get that right?
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Good. And Anne Adams is pretty easy. A-N-N-A-D-A-M-S. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. We look forward to seeing you in the course or this next call. We put these on every several months, and we hope that you enjoy them and get a lot out of them. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is Craig Wiener and Suzanne Fagel and Anne Adams with Tapping Out of Trauma.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.